Welcome to Summit Church. Here, we strive to be a church where you can belong long before you come to believe. At each of our locations, we worship together, learn and grow together, serve together, and form relationships around a common purpose, to inspire people to find and follow the way of Jesus. Join us in listening to this week's sermon.
Hey, what's up, Summit Online? So good to be with you today. Whether you are watching on YouTube or you're listening via podcast, I just want to say a special welcome to you. If you're watching online, I'd love for you to scan the QR code right there that's on your screen to connect with us. And if you're listening, love for you to email us and connect with our staff. We'd love to tell you more about why Summit Church is the place to be. Well, we're continuing a series of messages that we've been sharing over the last couple months called Kingdom Culture. Now, if this is your first time or maybe first time in a long time, you might be wondering why we're talking about kingdoms. Like, you're like, this is America, for goodness sakes. We don't have kingdoms here. And you'd be right. We don't have kingdoms here in America, but what we're not talking about is the castles and stuff. What we're talking about is spheres of influence over culture that it has over each and every one of us. That can, in and of itself, be a kind of kingdom. And what we've been saying is that Jesus, the King of God's kingdom, never invited us to just be Christians. He never intended us for us to fill up a building once a week, sing some songs, hear someone talk, sing another song, and then leave. Following Jesus is more than just what we do here on Sunday mornings. In fact, this is only one piece of the pie when it comes to following Jesus. Now, don't get me wrong. It's an important piece, but nonetheless, it's a piece. You see, Jesus invited us to be a part of his kingdom. In the first book of the New Testament called Matthew, we find Jesus teaching the original 12 disciples how to pray. And in the second line of what is commonly referred to as the Lord's Prayer, Jesus says this. He says, "May your kingdom come soon. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Now, this kingdom idea isn't about, like I said earlier, some castles or army or power. It's more than that. It's about influence, God's sphere of influence, which encompasses the entire known and unknown universe. Jesus is saying that God's kingdom and influence is coming, is here, and will be here to stay. And so this prayer acts as a plea to God to allow just a little bit of what's happening up there down here, so we can begin to experience the elements and traces of his kingdom right now. Today, what I want to discuss with you is how our love for others is a cultural value of God's kingdom. Now, I'm curious, has anyone ever had to endure a vision chart before? Like, I always feel like the eye doctor is trying to beat me at this made up and unfair game every time I have to take this test. You see, the vision chart is used to test our vision to see where it currently is. Now, our 15-year-old daughter has better than perfect eyesight the last time we all went to the doctor. Our 9-year-old son has almost perfect eyesight. But my wife, our middle daughter, and myself, we have the worst eyesight in the family. So if you've taken this test before, you know that they use these like special equipments that they place these lens over your eyes and the doctor will change them and he or she will ask you to read a certain row on this vision chart. And this test helps determine which of the following categories your sight might fall into, whether you're nearsighted, farsighted, or you have astigmatism. Now, while these terms are generally referred to your vision, I think we can also use them to describe the current state of how we love people. For instance, for some of us, we see the world through a nearsighted view. And what we mean by that is that it's a view of the world through a lens of me focus. It's where everything about life is all about ourselves. Like, we can see well up close and become pretty self-absorbed and self-centered and self-focused. Like, you're only looking at your life and you have no concern for the lives around you as long as your life is good, while not being bothered with others. Everyone else is kind of off in the distance and all their problems, all their hurts, all their desires, all their fears, they're just kind of foggy to you and you want to keep them out of focus for fear of messing up your own clear vision. You often hear people who view the world with a nearsightedness say things like, "Why should I concern myself with global poverty or racial reconciliation or sex trafficking or hurting people? Like, they got their problems and I got mine." So what they tell themselves is that if someone's not concerned about them, if someone doesn't forsake themselves for them, then they don't deserve their love. Now, some of us, we see the world through a far-sighted view. And what we mean by that is we see the world through a lens of others' focus. We focus on others. It's where we can see other people's stuff from the distance. We can discern and dissect their flaws from 100 yards away, but we can't see our own stuff. We're so quick to point out how others have failed, how our spouses have failed, how our friends have failed, how our bosses have failed, coworkers have failed, NFL quarterbacks have failed, famous people have failed, pastors have failed, but we can't see our own mishaps and our own mistakes. I mean, turn the attention to them, right? And they either shut you down or they go on the defensive, pointing out all your flaws. So here's what they tell themselves. They tell themselves that their love comes at a cost of perfection. Like if you mess up, if you fail at anything, you can't earn their love. And it doesn't matter that they're not perfect. You gotta be perfect. And then some of us see the world through stigmatism, okay? Now, for those of you who don't know or have this problem, your eye, your lens, it's curved more steeply in one direction than another. And this causes you to see with a distortion. So with astigmatism, people view the world with a distorted perspective. Like, we all sometimes view the world in this way. Like, we look at life and people and we assign them worth and value based on their size or shape or ability or disability, beauty, occupation, the color of their skin, their financial status, their political ideology, their sexual preference. I mean, you name it. It's judging people on what the culture of our world approves of or our own distorted thinking. And when you judge people like that, we stop seeing them as already worthy of God's love and therefore our love. So what they tell themselves is that because they voted for a certain candidate, hate them. Because they're oriented sexually or gender-wise in a way we disagree, shun them. They disapprove of my lifestyle choices because of how I feel oriented, shame them. They don't look like me, reject them. They don't have the same kind of money like me, ignore them. Now, I want to make this very clear right up top that this message isn't about sexual orientation or racial reconciliation or which side of the political spectrum you find yourself. Those are very important issues. But this isn't that. This is about people, regardless of where they are, who they are, and how they are, and how we should love them. We live in a world where there's so much hate that exists and continues to grow every day. But Jesus is calling us to a kind of love for people, friend or foe, that goes beyond the status quo. He wants us to stop viewing the world through a nearsighted view or a farsighted view or astigmatism. You see, in God's kingdom, its citizens don't achieve success or pleasure at the expense of others. Men don't objectify women. Women don't belittle men. Kids aren't trafficked. People don't use each other. They don't cheat to get ahead. They never flex their position or title to make things happen. They never pay back evil for evil. They don't hold grudges. In God's kingdom, people honor each other above themselves. They mourn with those who mourn. They celebrate with those when something good happens, even when it doesn't happen to them. They display the love, grace, and truth of Jesus in ways that call other brothers and sisters in Christ out of their sin into the good and glorious light. Citizens of God's kingdom understand that there will be disagreements, but fight for unity among one another. They do all they can to live at peace with each other. In God's kingdom, that is what love should look like. The King of God's kingdom, Jesus, gives us many beautiful pictures of what this love could and should look like. And one of Jesus's first followers, Matthew, we mentioned him earlier, captures in his writing Jesus talking about what it means to love someone truly. So in chapter 5, he records Jesus saying this: "You have heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friend, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that." Now, For some context, right before this, Jesus had just told them that retaliation isn't the best way to get revenge. And I can imagine the people kind of like exhaling like, okay, so don't exact revenge, fine. But at least I don't have to love or even like that other person. And Jesus starts with this, maybe sensing that in their heart, he's like, gosh, guys, it goes much deeper than that. And what Jesus is about to address are misconceptions about the law. Now, if you're joining us for the first time, or maybe you're still exploring what it means to follow Jesus, you need to know that the Bible is broken up into two major categories of books. You have the Old Testament and New Testament. In the Old Testament, before Jesus, God would relate to those who followed him via the law. The law was a set of rules that God's people had to live by. And it's not like our laws today, only those pertain to how we relate to each other and to God. Now, the first set of laws given is what is commonly referred to as the Ten Commandments. Another term for them were called the Ten Sayings. Now, we call them law, but you could also view them as like a covenant, a contract of understanding between God and humanity. If the people obeyed the laws, then God would be their God and they would be his people. And here's where the Ten Sayings, the Ten Laws that God set out. He says, you must have no other God but me. You must not make yourself an idol of any kind. You must not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Remember to observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Honor your mother and father. You must not murder. You must not commit adultery. You must not steal. You must not testify falsely against your neighbor. You must not covet your neighbor's stuff. Now, does that seem simple enough? Right? Should be. Well, if you were to go back to the New Testament, there's a moment when Jesus is asked, which of the greatest commandments or of the 10 sayings is the greatest? Now, we've talked about this response a lot over the last few months, but it bears repeating because it's essential to our faith and what it means to truly be a citizen of God's kingdom. Here's how Jesus responds. He says this. He says, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. Then he says the entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commands. Now, if you were to study that for a moment, you would quickly realize that the first part, loving God with heart, soul, mind, actually sums up the first five of the 10 commandments, the 10 sayings. And the second part, you know, loving your neighbor as yourself, summarizes the final five. Now, as a side note, the saying about love your father and mother can equally be applied to both sides. It's a really interesting study. I encourage you to take some time to look into that. But if you're looking at the 10 sayings and what Jesus said was the greatest of the sayings, it's like Jesus is trying to get us to see that if we removed all the frills, all the add-on demands, we find ourselves right back here. That at the end of the day, this kingdom's ruling law, the covenant from the king to the citizens, is to love the king and to love the king's people. But if we were to go deeper, we'd actually find that the law, these 10 sayings, were more than just a set of rules. We'd actually find that what Jesus is trying to convey is that the law was given to show us how far off and messed up we are and how we'll never get close to obtaining perfection or biblical term righteousness on our own. Somewhere along the way, after the law was given, the religious teachers and Pharisees started adding what they perceived the law was meant to dictate. So Jesus is going to address this misconception about what it means to love your neighbor. When Jesus says, you have heard it said that the law says, he's actually referring to Leviticus 19. And in verse 18, it reads this, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Okay. So here in the Old Testament, we have this very generous command to love our neighbors. Now, most modern day skeptics assume that the Old Testament is a story of a harsh God in a harsh time. Yet, we find these commands littered throughout the Old Testament. God commands his people to love their neighbor like they love themselves. In the same way we take care of ourselves and look after our own interests, we should take care of and be concerned for the interests of others. So for today's message, let's define what we mean by love, because using our own definitions of love will likely mean something completely different than how the Bible describes love. Okay? So when we talk about love and we talk about loving someone, here's what we mean: to feel or act lovingly. Now, you might be confused when you hear that definition, because love, according to our dictionaries, is an intense feeling of deep affection. But after talking to people in my time as a pastor, I am convinced of the partiality of that definition. Love shouldn't only be seen as something you feel, but also how you carry out those feelings, those actions. The word used as love in this verse means to make one the object of your affection. This is not about romantic feelings or actions. This is about genuine care and concern for another in such a way that you go out of your way to express that. You see, loving someone means that you desire, chase after, and seek after the concerns and interests of that person. You put their good before your own. Now, that's the key word, their good. And the reason why that's key is because sometimes we don't know what is good for us. Because we follow Jesus, we know the only good we need and seek is the good we find in Christ Jesus. That good often puts us at odds with people because they believe or think the world's version of good is good enough. But if we, Christ followers, genuinely love someone, we should want the good of Jesus for them. Now, let me quickly address what this doesn't mean, okay? This doesn't mean that we have to be approving or accepting or even tolerating someone's behavior or lifestyle if it doesn't align with what the Bible calls us to live in. Like, we don't have to be okay with it, but hear me, we still must love. We must find ways to display the love of God to our neighbors. And that's what this command in Leviticus 19 conveys. Love our neighbors like we love ourselves. Have concern for our neighbors like we have concern for ourselves. But the religious teachers took that command and concluded, well, if I ought to love my neighbor, then that must mean I must hate my enemy. You see, many first century Jewish people had a narrow view, narrow definition of who their neighbor was. They assumed that this text must have only been talking about their friends or their family or maybe those that were in their tribe, or in other words, they looked like them, they talked like them, they ate like them. I mean, you just name it, right? So fast forward hundreds of years later, and Jesus says, it's not enough to just love your neighbor. You have to go deeper than that. You need to love your enemies and pray for those who directly oppose you. Love and pray for those who don't look like you or like you or live like you or speak like you. Love and pray for those who want to see you fail, those who you disagree with, those who disapprove of you, those who hurt and left you. That is what it means to truly love your neighbor as yourself. Now, if you're like me, you've already told yourself, well, Michael, this is impossible. You can get on out of here with that mess. Like, there's no way I can measure up to that definition of love. I don't always feel love for the people close to me. How am I supposed to feel love for people who I don't like, people who oppose me, people who are different than me? Well, let me point out a couple of things, okay? See, love isn't all about emotion. Loving those who are close and those who are not isn't necessarily about the emotion. Just because we don't feel love for someone doesn't excuse us from loving them. Our love shouldn't be based solely on what we feel, but on the immeasurable grace and love that Jesus, the King of God's kingdom, extends to us. One of my best friends who lives in Missouri puts it perfectly. Chad says this, "Even our enemies are made in the image of God." And as we often say around here, you and I have never locked eyes with someone Jesus didn't die for. Man. And if, like us, our enemies were made in the image of God, and if they have such value that Jesus died for them, then we have no choice in the matter. We must love them regardless of whether we feel love for them. And then here's the other thing. It will be hard to love people who've hurt you. It's already hard to love people you're supposed to love, let alone people you don't want to love. And our world tells us to believe that anyone who isn't for us must be against us. Anyone who is different than us must be against us. Anyone who disapproves or disagrees with us must be against us. Listen to me. That is precisely where the enemy, the devil, wants you. In those moments, you've got to fight to keep a soft heart. You've got to fight to love again. Fight to keep love alive in your life and refuse to believe the lie. So Jesus comes along and he says the opposite. He says, if anyone is against you, love and pray for them. If anyone disapproves or disagrees, love and pray for them. If anyone is different from you, love and pray for them. These earthly kingdoms will tell you to put walls up, keep peoples at arm length, reject them if they choose to go a different way, shame them if they don't accept you as is, and condemn them if they reject your values. But King Jesus wants you and me to understand that kingdom love, God's kingdom love, is centered around loving those who are easy to love and loving those who are hard to love. So what I want to do is I want to give you three ideas of how we can express this kingdom love. And these three things, I will tell you, aren't the be-all, end-all of love, but they're more like starting points. You can start here, and as you progress, Jesus will give you the ability to expand your capacity to love people. People we're supposed to love and people whom the world says or we believe we shouldn't love. Here's number one. Begin to love without fear. Here's what I mean. Don't let fear dictate whom you should love. Remember, love, as we described it earlier, is acting lovingly. It means that you extend the same grace and love that Jesus extended to you to another. And when you begin to love fearlessly, you don't let what that person may have said or perceived or even done stop you from loving. Because the object of your love wasn't them, it was Jesus. Let me give you an example of this. There's a story about this lady named Eva Moses Kerr. She is a survivor of the Holocaust, and she goes to this court case with Oscar Goning. Oscar was a Nazi guard at Auschwitz during the time where Eva and her family were sent to that death camp. Oscar was on trial for what took place in the Holocaust. And in one moment, Eva comes up to him and introduces herself. They actually hug, and he kisses her on the forehead, a sign of remorse and a loving act. And Eva told Oscar she forgave him. That's loving without fear. That's a kingdom kind of love. That's what Jesus meant by loving your enemies and praying for them. It doesn't mean you have to start hanging out with them or let them back in your life or even trust them again. Loving without fear means that the object of your love is Jesus, so the foundation of your love isn't broken. So when someone doesn't love you well, you can still love them. Who's that person in your life at this point in time? Who have you been withholding your love and prayers for? This week, I want to challenge you to push yourself to forgive them, pray for them, and watch how God begins to change your heart for them. Here's number two, love without partiality. You see, our love shouldn't be based on who we like over who we don't like. When we love God with all that we have, a natural overflow of that love is to other people. Our love for God should lead us to love people regardless of whether they are friend or foe. Whether someone deserves our love isn't really up for debate. And here's lastly, love without conditions. Loving only those who can provide you something in return or those whom you're comfortable with brings you no real reward. Did you notice in Matthew chapter 5 how Jesus compares someone who only loves those who love them back with tax collectors and pagans? In the first century, if someone called you a tax collector or pagan, you'd be like trying to throw hands, right? Those fighting words. So Jesus doesn't mince words. He wants us to know very directly, loving with conditions gets you what you ask for. Conditions. And here's the thing. Broken people are broken. And eventually broken people become hurt. And hurt people. But loved people, well, they love people. You see, friends won't always be friends, and family won't always be family, and strangers won't always be strangers. Our love for them should never change, regardless of how they change, what they do, or if they never change. Our only expectation from loving the easy to love and the hard to love is that we get to show the same love Jesus gives to us. So let's be the kind of house, the kind of church that resists viewing people through the lens of our worldly culture, through a near-sighted lens, through a far-sighted lens, or a distorted view. Let's view people through the lens of God's kingdom. And maybe you're watching this right now, or you're listening, and you're just saying, man, God, I want to experience that kind of love. Maybe that kind of love that God gives us would help me love others. If that's you right now, if you've never experienced the love that Christ offers, can I just tell you, it's as simple. It's not easy, but it's as simple as admitting that you need Jesus, that your life has been devoid of love, of true, genuine, good love. So admit that you need Jesus. Would you believe that Jesus died for you, that he came from heaven, he gave you his life, and then he rose again? And then would you choose today to say yes to him and follow him all the days of your life? Can I tell you, if you made that decision right now, all of heaven rejoices, and so do we. And we would love to come around you to help you take your next right step in your faith journey. Reach out to us, email us, find us on social media. But we would love to continue to extend that kingdom kind of love to you and to those around you. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we're so grateful for you. Grateful that you have given us your love unconditionally, Father. There's nothing we have to do to earn your love. You freely offer it. So, Father, I pray that we would bask in that love and that an overflow of that love would flow into others. That, God, your Spirit would allow us, would propel us, would encourage us to love others, those that are easy to love and those that are hard to love. May we always display a kingdom kind of love. We pray this in Jesus' name, and the house said.
Thank you so much for listening with us today. Remember, you can also watch our services on YouTube or at summitchurchfl.org. Those links can be found in the show notes, along with ways to follow us on social media. Now, go in God's grace and peace. We look forward to worshiping with you soon.